Chapter 83, God's Vengeance and the Edit of Nantes. Look, there lies the King of France, sleeping peacefully. Peacefully? Just look once. For a moment a smile curls his lips, but then his face is suddenly distorted by fear. He raises the hands to ward off something. No, no, he cries with a suppressed voice. Restlessly, he turns himself around and around. He kicks with his feet and beats wildly with his hands. He wakes up with a shriek and looks about wildly. Great drops of perspiration stand in beads upon his brow. His entire body quakes and trembles. His fearful gaze wanders restlessly throughout the bedchamber. Thus it continues from night to night. The shed blood of the massacre of the Huguenots pursues him. After that ill-fated night, he did not have a moment's rest. His conscience accuses and condemns him. Even during the day, he is tormented by an inexpressible fear and terror. He imagines that he sees apparitions everywhere, which roam about him. Then he winces, shudders, and trembles. Oh, they are the spirits of those murdered ones, and they pursue him. He has no doubt about that. At night, dreadful, terrifying dreams wear him out and rob him of the highly necessary rest and relaxation. Day and night he lives in constant fear. That distressful life undermines his health. How else can it be? Like a phantom, he wanders restlessly through the palace. His eyes, which lie deep in their sockets, have a haunted look. He is wasting away to the bones, thus drags on his life. Life for him which has become hell before it is hell. Less than 2 years after the massacre of St. Bartholomew, he dies, being emaciated and exhausted, and is summoned before God's judgment seat. How terrible to appear before God like that. In this you see that God is an avenger. For a few days after the massacre of St. Bartholomew, the beheaded body of the noble de Coligny hung on the gallows. However, that did not hang there very long. His daughter, Lois de Coligny, has seen an opportunity to convey the mutilated body of her father to Holland. We do not know how that happened and who had the courage to remove that body from the gallows. In any event, it has happened. Louise de Coligny was married to a physician. Her husband was likewise murdered in the St. Bartholomew massacre. Later, she was married to Prince William of Orange, and she became the mother of Frederick Henry. Well, then, in her flight to the Netherlands, this courageous woman had the opportunity to take the corpse of her father with her. His mortal remains have rested in Holland till 1608. After that, it has been transferred back to France. First, it came to Paris, and later it has been transferred to his estate. There it rests until the last day. The sentence against him ran that he and his children were declared dishonorable. At that time, namely in 1572, a pillar of disgrace was erected on his estate. And in 1886, in the same Paris where they had vilified and mocked him, they have unveiled a statue in the inner court of the Protestant cathedral so that the remembrance of him would not be forgotten. And when, in 1912, the late Queen Wilhelmina visited Paris, she placed a wreath at the base of that statue. As is well known, she is a descendant of de Coligny. Do you not see in this the confirmation of the word of God, where it is written, "Them that honor me, I will honor"? As to the extermination of the Huguenots, such as had been originally planned, that was now out of the question. A tenth part was murdered, but nine-tenths remained alive. It is true, the largest part of the Huguenot nobility had fallen. The loss of Gaspard de Coligny was an irreparable blow to the Huguenots. Everywhere in the country, the embittered Huguenots armed themselves. Once again, a Huguenot war broke out. They fought with boundless embitterment and with mutual success. In the place of Charles IX, his brother Henry III became king. Henry of Navarre, who, as we told you already, had been compelled in the St. Bartholomew night to become Roman Catholic, revoked that later and placed himself on the side of the Huguenots. Yea, once more he became their leader. Henry de Guy, the murderer of de Coligny, made a strong alliance with the most prominent Roman Catholic nobles, which really turned itself against the King of France. In that way, there were actually three parties in France. King Henry III and his friends was the one party. Henry de Guy, who had made an alliance with Philip II of Spain, was the second party, and the Huguenots, with Henry of Navarre at the head, was the third party. Those three parties fought against each other. Because a Henry stood at the head of each party, this war was called the War of the Three Henries. We could tell you much more about that war, but then we would never get done. We shall tell you only a few facts. In course of time, the two Roman Catholic groups, namely Henry III, the king, and Henry de Guy, the leader of an alliance of the Roman Catholic nobles, concluded some sort of an armistice. Then they marched together to fight against the Huguenots, who, as we already wrote, stood under the leadership of Henry Navarre. The Roman Catholic Duke, Henry de Guy, was a big boss. He was a man exceptionally ambitious for power, who himself would have gladly ruled over France. He attempted to fully play the boss over the king, so that finally not Henry III but Henry de Guy had the greatest power. Finally, it became so bad that the king could no longer endure it, and Henry de Guy was murdered. A stab with a dagger put an end to his sinful life. The blood of Gaspard de Coligny was avenged, because you know already that Henry de Guy was the murderer of de Coligny. Did he not stand waiting outside till the corpse of de Coligny was cast out of the window, after which he trampled upon it? The French king went to his mother, the wicked Catherine de Medici. "Mother," he said, "I am now king alone again because I had Henry de Guy murdered." "My son," she answered with a smile, "now you must also have Charles de Guy, his uncle, murdered. Otherwise, you are still not safe." That advice was promptly followed. Immediately, the king had Charles de Guy arrested, and that powerful duke was also murdered. 14 days later, Catherine de Medici died. No one mourned about her death. She departed without being desired. Her wicked conduct of life was also at an end. God summoned her before his judgment seat. The Roman Catholic nobles were furious when they heard that the king had murdered both the guys, because now they were without their leaders. They brooded on revenge. The Jesuits also instigated the Roman Catholic nobles against their monarch. A few months later, a monk stabbed his dagger into the heart of the French king. He acted out of revenge. Thus also he, namely Henry III, fell by the hand of a murderer. All these people were the chief offenders of the Huguenot massacre during the notorious St. Bartholomew night. It is noteworthy that they all fell by the hand of murderers. Surely there is a God who lives, and upon this earth his sentence gives. The Lord is no idle beholder, but in his own time he shall destroy the wicked. This we see confirmed in this history. The confusion in France was great. Charles IX is dead. He died a miserable death. His brother and successor, Henry III, was murdered. Catherine de Medici is dead. Henry de Guy is murdered. His uncle, Charles de Guy, was also murdered. In this way, not one of the ancient royal house remained that was able to take the government of France upon himself. For that reason, in 1589, Henry of Navarre, the leader of the Huguenots, became king over the French realm. Who would have ever thought that? But the Roman Catholic Party, which was very powerful, said, "What? Henry of Navarre? A Huguenot king? That never. We will not think of acknowledging that heretic as king." Thus the war continued. Henry of Navarre fought for 4 years, but he made no headway. The Roman Catholic portion of the people rebelled against him. Paris locked the gates and refused to receive him. And then? Yea, that is bad. That which we must now tell you is very bad. Then Henry of Navarre, the leader of the Huguenots, became Roman Catholic again. Now he did not do it because of compulsion to save his life, but voluntarily to secure the crown. He said, "Paris is worth a mass to me." With that he meant, "If I only become Roman Catholic, then no doubt Paris shall open the gates for me." For that reason, he had himself solemnly admitted into the Roman Catholic Church. And, oh yes, he got his way. Now Paris did open the gates. The people of the French capital would not receive a Protestant king, but they would a Roman Catholic king. Yet it appears from this that Henry of Navarre was no God-fearing man. He despised the heavenly crown so that he could wear the earthly crown. He was really an apostate. However, we may say one thing about him. He never persecuted the Huguenots, his former co-religionists. From now on, his name was no longer Henry of Navarre, but Henry IV. Immediately after his coronation, he tried to put an end to the bloody Huguenot War. In this, he was successful. In 1598, a conference between the Roman Catholics and the Huguenots took place in Nantes, a large seaport in France. Those two parties made peace with each other. In that city, a treaty of peace was concluded between them. Another word for treaty is edit. Because that treaty was made in the city of Nantes, this is known in history as the Edit of Nantes. This Edit of Nantes was very favorable to the Huguenots. They obtained freedom of conscience and religious liberty. That means no matter where they lived, not one would be persecuted because of his faith. That was really something exceptional, because in all Roman Catholic countries, freedom of conscience was not given. Rome does not want to know anything about freedom of conscience. That surely was not to the liking of the Pope. In the second place, the Huguenots obtained the right to establish their own churches and schools. Those schools were especially important because in them their children would be instructed in the pure doctrine of salvation. In the third place, they were permitted to freely exercise their reformed religion. They even obtained access to public offices. That meant that they could even hold office in the national government and also in that of the cities. The courts of justice would consist of 50% Huguenots, so that they would not be delivered over to the hatred and arbitrariness of the Roman Catholic judges. And finally, they obtained some towns as security. The most important of those Huguenot cities was La Rochelle, a strong seaport on the west coast of France. Because of those security cities, the Huguenots really formed a little separate state, hence a state within the state. After so many years of war and oppression, the Huguenots at last obtained rest. Finally, they could assemble undisturbed and attend their divine services without fear. During the reign of Henry of Navarre or Henry IV, France recovered slowly from the devastations which had been caused during the Huguenot Wars. As we already wrote, the Edit of Nantes was signed against the wish of the Pope. Also, the Jesuits have never forgiven Henry IV. They continued to stir up strife and to incite the Roman Catholic people against their king. Their underground stirring was crowned with success in 1610. In that year, Henry IV was murdered by a monk, Revilic by name. Henry IV was not a God-fearing king, for he led a sinful life. Neither was he a steadfast ruler, because he changed his religion repeatedly. But he has been an instrument in the hand of God to give rest for some time to the severely tried Huguenots. Through it all, God has maintained his church. We just wrote, the Huguenots obtained rest for some time. Thus, not permanently? Oh no, alas no. After a lapse of time, dark clouds again gathered above the Huguenots. We shall hear of that. We write, October 1627. The gates of the strong Huguenot city of La Rochelle are closed. Sturdy soldiers with the gun at their feet watch upon the strong walls. Their eyes stare sharply into the distance, because outside lies a strong army which entirely surrounds the city from the land side. La Rochelle is being besieged. Thus, war again? Alas, yes. It is 17 years ago that Henry IV was murdered by a fanatical monk. Louis XIII became king in his place. His chief servant, we would say his prime minister, was Cardinal Richelieu. This cardinal was an able but crafty statesman. His main object was to make France great and strong, and to bring the royal house to honor and renown. We already know that the Huguenots had received various cities as security. They really formed a state within the state, isn't that so? That last was a thorn in the eye of Cardinal Richelieu, that the Huguenots had obtained freedom of religion with the Edict of Nantes. Yes, that was bad enough. But that the Huguenots had their own strong cities, no, Richelieu could not tolerate that. That went too far for him. Besides, in case of war, that could become dangerous to France. Just imagine that in such a case the Huguenots would choose the side of France's enemies. Then France would have the enemy upon its own soil. How much misery could proceed from that? An end had to be made to that, no matter what it cost. For that reason, Richelieu slowly took one city after another away from them. Although the Huguenots resisted, yet the true unity was lacking among them. What a pity it was that at all times divisions prevailed among the Protestants. Thus it was in Germany, we have treated of that, and thus it was now also in France. And is it not presently exactly the same? And now in 1627, Richelieu had laid siege around La Rochelle, the last Huguenot city. That last city must also fall, and then at least the danger for internal betrayal was averted. But the Huguenots defended themselves bravely. They had no intention of abandoning their last stronghold so easily. Weeks, yea, months passed by slowly. It became 1628. La Rochelle stood firm because the seaside was still open, and from that side provisions, weapons, and soldiers could get into the beleaguered fortress. Richelieu realized that if he wanted to conquer La Rochelle, then the seaside had to be closed off too. In this way, the fortress could hold out for years. The resistance of the Huguenots had to be broken. And then, yea, we think it very bad that we must write it down. But then the Dutch fleet also assisted to block La Rochelle from the seaside. Perhaps you shall ask, rather surprised, how can that be now? We can understand that because the Dutch were co-religionists of the Huguenots, were they not? Yes, certainly, that they were too. But the Netherlands were still involved in the severe struggle with Spain. The 80 Years' War was still raging. It is true, the Spaniards themselves had been driven out of the country, but they were still fighting. Besides, rumors penetrated into the Netherlands about a large fleet which Spain was preparing against the Netherlands. And now that crafty Richelieu made it appear as if he would help and support the Dutch in their struggle against Spain. That French offer was really alluring to the Dutch government. With French assistance, Spain would soon be forced to make peace. But in exchange for that assistance, the Netherlands must also give a helping hand to Richelieu in the conquering of La Rochelle. No, the French cardinal assured them that it was not his intention at all to persecute the Huguenots again. There was no thought of that. His only object was to break the political power of the Huguenots. Nothing more than that. they absolutely would not be interfered with in the exercising of their religion. The Edict of Nantes would remain in force. Only the security cities would be taken away from them. There was nothing against that, was there? The end of it all was that the States General of the Netherlands sent a fleet to France to completely block La Rochelle, also from the seaside, so that the supply of provisions would be made impossible to the last stronghold of the Huguenots. The indignation was great in that country, and we can understand that. It was not necessary either. Without the support of France, the Netherlands still would have compelled Spain to make peace. Thus far, the Lord had helped the Netherlands wonderfully and kept them standing. Must now the help of France be accepted at such a price? Everywhere in the church services, prayer was made for the Huguenots. The sailors had little desire to be used for that purpose. However, the government carried it through. They had to obey. According to some writers, the Dutch fleet came too late and did not cooperate in the fall of La Rochelle. According to them, the city had already surrendered before the fleet arrived. According to Freytier, the Dutch did have their ships used to overthrow La Rochelle. However it may be, in any event, the Dutch government did make the fleet ready against the city of La Rochelle, and that in itself was a crying shame. The English sent provisions, powder, and bullets to La Rochelle. At that time, Richelieu was supposed to have cut off the city by means of a dam in the sea, by which finally famine began to prevail in the beleaguered city. Yet the Huguenots held out, but the distress mounted. People died daily from the famine. According to some, at one time 300 died in one day. Finally, the city had to surrender because it could no longer hold out. In October 1628, La Rochelle opened the gates. Richelieu, with his victorious army, marched into the city, and the papal mass was celebrated in one of the Protestant churches. What a blow for the Huguenots. After the surrender of La Rochelle, Cardinal Richelieu has kept his word to that extent that the Huguenots were not openly persecuted. They retained their religious liberty, but the political power of the Huguenots was broken, and that was a heavy blow to them. From that moment, they were constantly exposed to vexation from the side of Rome, and they could no longer do anything against that. They had lost their power. Ultimately, this has contributed toward their final submergence into a sea of blood and tears. But we hope to tell you something about that in the next chapter.